Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Christogenos, along with my co-host, Pastor William Fink. This is the second installment of the Book of Isaiah. And the first three chapters were very, very interesting. We talked about the prophecies that included, is that an April Fool's joke, Mark? And that he couldn't get on, he doesn't have audio, or he's just going to have to get the messages from people in the chat room, that's all, okay? And so we definitely had a prophecy of America and contained in the first three chapters, and a lot of talk about people adorning themselves and becoming materialistic and, you know, basically not acting like true Israelites should. The kind of sums up the first three chapters. Any you know, summary from you here, Bill, on the first three chapters before we get into chapter four?
No, except that we saw time and again, we saw parallels with our condition today.
That's right.
And again, we're being overrun with aliens.
Right.
And it's there's no mistake that the same behavior on our part leads to our punishment.
Yes, it's the Deuteronomy.
It's the same exact pattern all over again.
The curses of Deuteronomy 28, whenever our people as a nation sin, the curses of Deuteronomy 28 apply full scale and full tilt, as it were, these days. We're watching our society simply self-destruct for lack of morality.
And we'll see that here also.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go into chapter 4, verse 1. And in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by your name to take away our reproach. Now, of course, this prophecy, and I believe it's referred to at Luke 1:25, if I'm not mistaken. But this has to be a prophecy, although it may have happened in the days of ancient Israel, because Israel was always engaged in one war after another. And the seven women would desire the same man for a husband, because apparently a great war depleting the ranks of the males in the society, right? Wouldn't that be the case here for verse 1?
You know something? I have a strange parallel here. I don't know if it works or not, but there are seven of the eight beasts are left.
Okay.
And every one of those beasts were empowered by our race.
That's right. That's right.
Every single one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's an odd parallel. But as far as that, I don't see this in the New Testament.
Right.
I'm sorry. I see Luke 8. I did a search on seven women, and I don't see this again in the New Testament. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But it just shows that Israel is chosen of Yahweh, and I think that other nations would try to cling to Israel. And,
mm-hmm.
and every
yes, they will.
As every well, the Assyrian Empire rose to power, but I think that was Yahweh's. You know, Yahweh's way to punish Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Babylonian Empire rose to power because of Israel.
Right.
And every subsequent empire rose to power because of, or with the stock of Israelite blood.
Right.
And that's true of the Medo-Persian, the Babylonian. And it was the Scythians who destroyed Assyria, which allowed the Babylonian Empire to rise to power, to gain hegemony.
Yeah.
And every subsequent empire is and world beast has been empowered by us.
Okay. So that's interpreting the seven women as being the seven beasts of the book of Revelation?
Well, I think that's a possibility. There's seven beasts left at this point if we count the Assyrians as still standing, which they are.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still Assyrians. There's still Assyrians alive today. You know, there's no doubt about that. And there's still Persians. I don't know about the Medes. The very few people call themselves Medes.
But
the Greek?
A lot of the people that we know as Slavs are actually Assyrians and Medes.
Right. Okay. So, and all these, all the empires have vanished. The people that were part of those empires still exist today in that ethnic reality. They still do. Yeah,
and they're trying to cling to us.
That's right. That's right, and we're unfortunately leading them all into perdition with our adoption of Jewish customs. right? And Judeo-Christian customs, okay?
Well, right, and that's a lot more complicated.
That's
than
right,
than
yeah.
That.
Okay, all right, verse 2. In that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel, okay? So if we're here talking about the Israelites who escaped from the Assyrian captivity, yes, our people have created a beautiful and glorious civilization.
Well, right, and this is, the Jewish version of history, these people went into captivity in Assyria and never were heard from again.
Right.
That they were destroyed there or amalgamated and were never heard from again. But
mm-hmm.
the all of the prophecy concerning the deported Israelites is absolutely contrary.
Yeah, to what the Jews and Judeo-Christians teach about the ancient Israel. Exactly.
Right, and the prophecy only agrees with what we teach about and what we believe the archaeology and the history teach about ancient Israel.
Right, right. Yes. Okay, verse 3, and it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remains in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem. Now, we can do this historically. We can interpret the word Jerusalem historically here, talking about the house of Judah still existing in Judea at this time, okay? But also Jerusalem is always also a prophetic Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem is obviously prophetic. And
well, I believe it moves with the people.
Right, exactly.
It's the mass body of the people, that this is a more or less an assurance that when the Israelites are taken out of the land and go to become their glorious, the glorious tree and the fruit of the earth, that there wouldn't be any Hittites among them at that time. I mean, they caught up to us later.
Right.
But at that time, that we can be rest assured that they went alone.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So as our people were cast into the wilderness of Europe, there weren't any people for it had to be quite some time from 700 BC until probably 200 AD.
Well, the last of the great migrations into Europe, as far as the Saxons and the Celtic people are concerned, didn't happen until after the fall of Rome.
Right. Yeah. I was just going to say that it was around 200 AD. That the major clashes between the Germans, Celts, Franks, etc., and the Romans began occurring.
Well, right. It's 200 AD when the Goths crossed the Danube,
mm-hmm.
thereabouts, yes.
And so, but that was internecine warfare. That was Israelite versus Israelite of different nations.
Well, that may have been the way Yahweh sinned the herd and
mm-hmm.
cleansed it.
Right. Could be. Yes, yes. Okay. Verse 4. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. So all these internecine wars among the Germans, the Vikings, the British, the Romans, et cetera, that's this purging. Okay? It's purging out the non-white blood, the non-Israel blood, from among the Israelite people.
And I'm sure a lot of disobedient white blood went with it.
Of course.
Or probably even some good white blood.
Yeah, right. No, well, no doubt. Yeah, because these were major wars, you know. There's a constant intertribal warfare going on among the Israelite people who were, of course, spoke different languages, such as German, Latin, French, Greek, et cetera, and because there was the language barrier, they had numerous wars, et cetera, and they were all fighting amongst themselves and killing each other.
Well, we weren't in this country 80 years. We were, as our own nation,
right.
Without the English king ruling over us, and we were killing each other.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the Civil War. Okay, so verse 5, and Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flame fire by night, for upon all the glory shall be a defense. Okay, this word defense, have you had a chance to look up, for upon all the glory shall be a defense? I'm not sure what this verse would mean.
No, but give me a second.
I'll read verse 6 while you're looking that up. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge and for a covert from storm and from rain. A covert being, of course, a place of refuge, usually like under a bridge.
And that's what that defense is. It's a canopy or a covering.
Okay.
It's not a defense.
All right.
Well,
okay.
It could be, but
okay,
that's
so,
not necessarily the context here.
Yeah, so canopy and covert being very similar words then. And so, in other words, we're talking about this violent, all this internecine warfare, but the remnant shall have refuge from the storm. So apparently what's happening here, it's describing the washing away of the filth of the daughters of Zion. And, of course, that would include the giving up of paganism and turning to Christianity, right?
Well, right. The bottom line here is that the good people are taken out of the land for their own good.
Right. That's right.
They're taken away from a wicked nation for their own good.
Uh-huh. So they couldn't practice all those pagan rituals anymore with the Canaanites.
Well, stop corrupting the nation.
That's right.
Stop corrupting the people.
Yes.
Most Americans today, most white Americans, are basically good people.
That's right.
It's those outside influences that continually corrupt us.
Yeah, the pornography,
the television, the sports, the entertainment. It's those influences which consistently corrupt our people.
Yeah, they keep on imitating the Jews. That's basically what our people do. Yes. Okay, chapter 5, verse 1. Now will I sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard.
Now let me say that this is Isaiah is mimicking Israel here.
Yeah, okay.
Playing the role of the wife.
Okay.
And Yahweh is the husband and the vineyard and the vineyard master.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is basically it's the parable of the vineyard before it happens.
Right.
This is the same parable of the vineyard. Vineyard is Christ gave us.
Mm-hmm.
Almost,
yeah.
Except it's 2,500 years before.
Exactly.
It's before the vineyard's loaned out to the husbandman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he fenced it and gathered out the stones thereof and planted it with the choicest vine and built a tower in the midst of it and also made a wine press therein. And he looked that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. This can only be the European dispersion.
Well, this is Jerusalem. This is the land, and that, you know, Palestine is the vineyard.
Okay.
But the grapes were wild grapes.
Wild
grapes. Didn't do what they were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see that up sprang briars and thorns.
Okay.
But which is like you always say, when Israel sins, Jews happen.
Right. Exactly, yes. Okay, verse 3. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, okay, now we're definitely talking about Judah and literal Jerusalem, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. Okay. Judge between the two. And his vineyard has got like a lot of wild grapes in it, right? Verse 4. What could have been done more to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. Okay? So Yahweh is asking, you know, well, how come I've given you everything you could possibly want, and you still rebel against me?
It is exactly what he's saying.
Yeah, yeah. Verse 5, and now go to.
Now that should be, and now listen.
And now listen. Okay. That's really archaic. Go to. I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. Okay, so this is literally now Jerusalem. Verse 6, and I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned nor dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looked for judgment, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry. Now, of course, now in verse 7, the vineyard is the house of Israel.
Right, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. And if we go outside of Isaiah to similar references, we find in Jeremiah 2:21, Yahweh asks rhetorically, yet I had planted thee a noble vine, a holy right seed. How then art thou turned into the degenerate plant of a strange vine unto me?
Right.
And Yahweh knows the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
They're the briars and thorns. The
yeah.
briars and thorns are the Canaanite, Edomite interlopers.
That's right.
That's why Ezekiel said at 16:3, speaking of the same thing, and say, thus saith Lord Yahweh God unto Jerusalem, thy birth and nativity is of the land of Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
Thy father was an Amorite, and thy mother a Hittite.
Right.
That doesn't mean that all of the people in Jerusalem are mixed.
Right.
But it's drawing an illustration that this is who you're following after.
Right. Yeah. The usurpation is definitely led by those people, and yeah, and then the Judahites, and of course the Israelites also, were following in their footsteps by performing these Canaanite rituals.
We have a whole generation of Americans today. The same thing could be said about them.
That's right. Absolutely. So the vineyard is the house of Israel, folks. It's not the church. And there's no way that this language can be sloughed off of Israel and given to a church, okay? The vineyard is the people of Israel, period, okay? There can be no spiritualization of this verse. And, of course, when Yahshua Messiah speaks of the vineyard, that he is the vine and we are, the fruits of the vine, he's only speaking of Israel, folks. Okay, verse 8. Woe to them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no place, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. Okay, this seems pretty obvious, but let me get your interpretation of verse 8 here.
Well, it seems that because they like to crowd together and cohabitate in the city, that they be pushed out into a desolate, into a more barren place.
Right. Well, I think, too, it means that we're becoming too, cosmopolitan.
Well, right, too yeah. urban, too right.
Yes, right. And typically, when our people get crowded in by other races, what do they do? White flight, right? They move to the suburbs, okay? And then the suburbs get crowded in, and then they move back to the farm, okay? That's literally what's happening today, folks. Okay, verse 9. In my ear said Yahweh of hosts, of a truth, many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant. Folks, I just spent the last week on various jobs in the city and in the suburbs. And I've never seen so many boarded up houses. I've never seen so many boarded up houses. Chicago has managed to, weather the storm, because California has had a couple of major economic declines where repossessed homes and foreclosures happen on a huge basis, okay? That hasn't happened in Chicago, but it is happening now.
Well, there's actually, I noticed two houses here in the last couple of weeks that
uh-huh.
boarded
yeah.
up. And there weren't, I don't recall one boarded up house when I came here last year.
I had never heard a repo commercial in the city of Chicago until the last couple of years. Never. Okay. Now it's becoming, it's not commonplace yet, but I'm seeing more and more boarded up homes more than ever before. Never used to see that. You'd see it in Gary, Indiana, Rockford, Illinois, and small town America, and in Detroit, obviously, okay? But I never used to see boarded up homes in the city of Chicago. I'm starting to see it right now, okay?
Well, I remember just before I got out, I was reading, maybe about 6 months before I got out, before I came home, I was reading a paper, and the article said that a new Walmart had opened up.
Yeah.
Right over the Chicago city line in one of the suburbs.
Right.
And like 30,000 people applied for 300 jobs.
Right.
It was some ridiculous number just like that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's how we're very poor straits and the welfare system is not working, folks. They can't get enough welfare to support themselves anymore. Okay. Of course, we, the white taxpayers, have been footing the bill. And they've been impoverishing us at the same time, okay? All right, so verse 10, yea, 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, whatever a bath and a homer.
Well, it's, you know, it's a very small unit of measure that, mm-hmm. you know, for a 10-acre harvest.
Okay.
Yeah, yes. You know, it's something you'd expect from a family garden, maybe.
Right. And even though in the history of America we've always had huge harvests, the fact is our people haven't been getting it. The harvests have been given away, like during the days of the Soviet Union. Jewish middlemen like the Freiberg family would, you know, the government would, you know, take the grain, use the Jew as the middleman, and ship it off to Russia, to the Soviet Union. Okay? It's our grain. The government and the international Jew have conspired to deprive us of our grain, you know, so they can make a profit. Okay?
A bath is very much like a Greek amphora. It's 9 gallons.
9 gallons? Okay.
Yes.
And the seed of a homer shall yield an ephah. Okay? Any idea of those measures, what they mean?
An ephah is... Why am I not being told?
Yeah, let me continue until you find it.
Well, well, it tells me it's 10 omers and 3 seahs and
okay.
it also says about 9 gallons. So for some strange reason,
okay.
Well, one is an ephah is dry.
Oh, okay.
And it says about 9 gallons, and a bath is liquid, and it says about 9 gallons.
Okay, so
maybe they really
talking
don't
about
know.
Grapes, wine, or grape juice, or something like that. And then so Homer is a measure of seed of some kind. Okay. All right, verse 11. Woe to them that rise up early in the morning that they may follow strong drink that continue until night till wine inflame them. Well, we have a lot of taverns in the city of Chicago where this kind of thing goes on constantly. Okay, verse 12. And the harp and the viol and the tabret and the pipe and wine are in their feasts, but they regard not the work of Yahweh, neither consider the operation of his hands. Yeah.
Well, this, you know, verses 10 and 11, it just basically says woe to the party culture.
Right, right.
That we have in all of our cities,
mm-hmm.
and the shorelines and, you know, the whole spring break thing. And
that's right.
It's going on right now. But I mean, back in New Jersey, I know people that lived to work in the club.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all they ever did was work in club.
Right. Right. Yes. Verse 13, therefore my people are gone into captivity because they have no knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Yeah, and there is a drought of honorable men.
Now, as we will see, we're
women,
not at the captivity yet, so Isaiah is speaking... He's speaking prophetically.
Yes, exactly.
And he may be speaking metaphorically about captivity being the captivity to worldly desires.
Yes,
but I think he's speaking prophetically that they're
right.
gone into captivity. The Assyrians just haven't come yet.
Yes, yes. Well, all of these verses, even though several of them refer very specifically to literal Jerusalem, there's simply no doubt that we're also speaking of prophetic Jerusalem as well, okay? And that is wherever the Israelites are, okay? Wherever we have a civilization, these things happen to us because of our disobedience. That's simply all. And we are definitely in captivity now.
Well, I'm convinced that Mount Zion is our Yah, the Mount
That's
of
right.
Yahweh.
It's, yeah, well, it's, yeah, it's our civilization,
the,
our
the
government.
The Aryan people.
The way it should be, of course, not the way it currently is, okay? Because they have no knowledge, and that's the way our Israelites are today. They were just like that in Judah before the Babylonian captivity. And their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. And that's exactly what we've got. People, they claim to be honorable. They claim to be good and decent, and they're not, because they commit crimes of omission. They may not be committing crimes of commission, but they're committing numerous crimes of omission, and allowing all kinds of government corruption to take place. Verse 14, therefore hell has enlarged herself and opened her mouth without measure, and their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he that rejoices shall descend into it. Okay? It's a literal prophecy of what came to pass in the house of Judah, and it's going to happen again, folks. Verse 15, and the mean man shall be brought down.
Now, let me say that word mean is not in the text.
Oh, it's not?
No.
Okay.
There's no adjective in the text.
Okay.
And Adam shall be brought down.
Oh, okay, and Adam.
There's no article, but the word is for man is Adam, and there's
right.
no adjective attached to it.
So the article is not there either?
No, the article's not there, and the adjective's not
okay.
there.
Okay. Interesting, because usually the King James will give us
italics.
Italics.
I understand that. And the Breton also adds words here that aren't in the Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And the NAS is the only version I found in Bible words, you know, that I list.
Mm-hmm.
I don't look at them all, which does put the added words in italics.
Okay, as they should be.
Yeah.
They're not in the original text. Yes, okay. And man and Adam shall be brought down.
Now, man is not in the next one. It's end of he of importance, literally.
Okay.
Shall be disgraced. I just thought I'd mention
yeah.
a little
well, yeah.
idiosyncrasies in the translation.
Right.
It,
yeah.
It, yeah, you know, it makes sense to me that Adam, yeah, you know, throughout the whole period, if you go look at the Psalms, David's always referring to the children of Israel as the children of Adam, the sons of Adam, the
right.
sons of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
It's always translated the sons of man.
Right.
But it's the sons of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, our,
yeah.
you know, the children of Israel are the life force of our race since, you know, the Exodus from Egypt.
Right, right, exactly.
You know, even though there were other white nations around them, the children of Israel were the dominant people of our race since
of
the
Adam.
Exodus from Egypt.
Yes.
Yahweh only raised up the Assyrians in order to punish the children of Israel.
Right, right. Well, there's simply no doubt that I might as well bring it up at this point because the book Genesis Disclosed by Thomas A. Davies, which is on my website, anglo-saxonisrael.com, where he talks about this over and over, how the word man is a substitute for the word Adam, and that there's other words such as ish that are translated as man, and that word is not necessarily a reference to Adam. It can be, but not always. Okay?
Right. And Enosh is actually used of Adam in a debasing or in a human
right,
sense.
Right. Enosh would be another one. And so the King James and all these other translations make no distinction among these words and translate them all as man when that should not be done. Okay?
Well, there's many places where Enosh and Adam are actually opposed to one another.
Right. Right. And the translation should reflect that, but it does not.
No.
Okay. Verse 16. But Yahweh of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God that is holy shall be sanctified in righteousness. Okay? And righteousness is justice, obedience to the law. Verse 17. Then shall the lambs feed after their manner, and the waste places of the fat ones shall strangers eat. Okay? We're seeing that happening right now. Okay? It's strangers who have come into our country that are eating all our produce, right?
Right, and they're obviously not accepted into his covenants.
That's right.
I mean, just from the context, have we not prophesied in your name? Get away from me! I never knew you.
That's right.
And Peter talks about those clouds without water that feast with us in our own feasts. Yeah, you know, and proudly vaunt themselves This is what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
These other races that are feasting together with us in this day and age, they're still strangers. They're
That's
not
right.
accepted.
Yeah, right. They're just and it's the Judeo-Christian churches that are promoting this race-mixing feast. Okay? A perfect example would be Hurricane Katrina, where all those blacks from New Orleans were given all kinds of free food, free housing. Some of them moved in with white, you know, very generous white families.
Very stupid white.
Yeah, and their daughters got raped and they got stolen from those blacks who they were very generously treating, right? Okay. Maybe a few of those white families learned something. Okay. Maybe a few of them did. Okay. Well, we're not supposed to do that kind of thing, folks. We're supposed to stay separate. Okay. Verse 18, woe to them that draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as it were with a cart rope. Okay. So, well, we drag our iniquity along with us, don't we? that sounds like that's what this verse is saying.
Well, let's see the Septuagint.
Okay. I'll keep reading as
Yeah, and iniquity is as with a song of the heifer's yoke. I guess we are servants to sin.
Yeah, right.
That's what that's saying.
And the churches are causing it to do this because they have hooked us up. They have hooked up the entire cart. You know, into you know, what's that verse? Second Corinthians, be not unequally yoked
with aliens.
It says with aliens is the correct translation, right?
Right, outside of the faith.
Be not unequally yoked with aliens. Okay, verse 19. Let's say, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it, and let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. Well, I wish our people were saying this today. Verse 20. Woe to them, here's a very famous verse now here. Woe to them that call evil good and good evil, liberals, folks, that we're talking about here.
Well, right. It's everybody that has broken down our society and what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
Three generations ago, we knew interracial marriage was wrong.
That's right. And
homosexuality was evil.
It's suddenly good, right?
it's good. It's
and
virtuous.
We who oppose it are evil. Yes.
It's basically virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
They're favoring homosexual couples and adoptions.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so these verses, these verses of Isaiah, number one, refer literally to ancient Jerusalem and the house of Judah, and prophetically to prophetic Jerusalem and the whole house of Israel, okay?
And that's because history repeats itself, because we obviously don't learn from it.
Boy, am I getting tired of seeing history repeat itself, okay? Completing this verse, woe to them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light, and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter. It's liberalism. It's the liberalism of the white race turning the teachings of the Bible completely backwards. And unfortunately, Bill, the churches are just as guilty as the liberals for accepting all of this perversion and calling it good.
Well, Isaiah 32:5 will read that the vile person shall no more be called liberal. In other words, he'll be called what he really is.
Yeah, the vile person, right?
And that day is soon.
That's coming real soon, yes. Verse 21, woe to them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. Okay, well, we all like to flatter ourselves, don't we? Okay, but we have certainly. The Judeo-Christians, especially those who follow the gospel of personal gratification, are guilty of this.
Well, while the liberal progressive mind and the Jewish humanist mind, mm-hmm. they know better than God.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, and so do the Judeo-Christians. You know, the ones who say, well, the law has been abolished, and the ones who say we're all saved despite our evil deeds. Okay. That's what the churches are teaching today.
And it's contrary to, absolutely
yeah.
contrary to Scripture.
That's right. Verse 22. Woe to them that are mighty to drink wine. Here we go with the wine bibbers. And men of strength to mingle strong drink, which justify the wicked for reward and take away the righteousness of the righteousness from him. Now of course, strong drink and wine can also be symbolic of the delusion, the liberal delusion, that has captured the mentality of our people today. There's simply no doubt, because what follows, which justify the wicked for reward.
Well, right, and that describes the people that
the politicians
the politicians that get into office by going along with the program of the enemy.
That's right, The liberal traitors. All liberals are traitors. Absolutely. Verse 24. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root shall be as rottenness and their blossom shall go up as dust because they have cast away the law of Yahweh of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. That describes the Judeo-Christians too.
Well, yes, it does. And the last verse of the last part of verse 23, and take away the righteousness of the righteous.
Mm-hmm.
The words from him are actually a misreading of the preposition by the King James translator.
Okay.
They don't belong in the text.
Okay.
And take away the righteousness of the righteous is what they do today.
That's right.
But when they flog the conservative class of people. Not to speak in the Republican, party
yeah.
sense, but
sure.
the true conservatives,
yes.
they flog them with political correctness,
yeah.
with these tolerance classes,
Right.
And trying to retrain their minds into something
different. Brainwashing, yes.
Well, right. And separatism and upholding of the laws of Yahweh are evil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not that Ronald Reagan was really a true conservative, but you could see how the liberal press just vilified that man just for speaking conservative rhetoric, right? It was incredible to behold.
And he was only an actor.
That's right.
He didn't even really mean it.
Right, right. But the liberal press just went ape. Every time he said, when he said that the Soviet Union was the evil empire, they had a fit, right? Oh, how could he say such a thing? Well, it was true.
Well, right, it was true, but you know, it only fed into the Rothschild game.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
In the long run.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, because what's his name? Glenn Beck does it.
They're all Rothschild whores. They're all whores for the Jews.
Yeah. We have actors who pretend to be conservatives, and we have actors who pretend to be liberals. And those two go at it on national television, on the talk shows. And they pretend that they seriously believe the theology that they preach. Right?
Well, right.
But they're just actors.
Glenn Beck's a race mixer, and Alex Jones is married to a Jewess, and there's no righteousness in any of them.
None of them are conservative. They just pretend to be, right? Very good. Okay. Therefore, verse 25, is the anger of Yahweh kindled against his people, and he has stretched forth his hand against them and has smitten them hundreds of times, literally. And the hills did tremble, and their carcasses were torn in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. So despite all of our constant and repeated rebellion against him, he still is reaching out his hand to us, looking for those of us, the remnant, who will finally obey his law. Okay, verse 26. And he will lift up an ensign to those nations from afar, and will hiss to them, and hiss what?
Well, the nations from afar here are the Assyrians and their allies who are going to come against Israel.
Okay. Okay.
And the ensign is his drawing them to conquer Israel.
Okay. All right.
And we'll see, you'll get to a line here about the prey, and the prey is Israel.
Okay. Okay. And so the word hiss, I'm not sure, hiss to them from the end of the earth. A hissing would be, something that a confusion noise. Okay, I have a note.
It's a whistle. It's a signal.
Okay, we'll signal to them. Okay.
Yes.
He will signal to them from the end of the earth, and behold, they shall come with speed swiftly. Talking, of course, you're saying here the Assyrians. Okay. None shall be weary nor stumble among them, none shall slumber nor sleep, neither shall the girdle of their loins be loosed, nor the latchet of their shoes broken, whose arrows are sharp, and all their bows bent, their horses' hooves shall be counted like flint, and their wheels like a whirlwind. So this is going to be a very imposing, formidable army. Verse 29, their roaring shall be like a lion, they shall roar like young lions, yea, they shall roar, and lay hold of the prey, and shall carry it away safe, and none shall deliver it. So he's guaranteeing that this captivity is going to take place. Okay.
Right, and that deliver is really rescue or stop it from being carried away.
Mm-hmm.
In this context.
Right.
And this is talking. This is he's foreboding the deportations which are about to happen.
Exactly. Verse 30. And in that day they shall roar against them like the roaring of the sea. And if one look to the land, behold, darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened in the heavens thereof. Okay, so we are simply being told here, this is Isaiah prophesying the Assyrian captivity, folks. All right? Chapter 6, verse 1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And above it stood the seraphims, and the seraphims are angelic beings.
Well, a seraphim actually seems to be a winged serpent.
Okay.
And we really only know that. We can really only tell that. I don't think there's anywhere where seraphims are actually described.
Uh-huh.
Except that the ensign that Moses raised in the desert, it's called a seraph. And
okay.
Seraphim is actually the plural version, the plural form of that word.
Right.
It's a seraph, and that's what's later described as a serpent.
A winged serpent.
Yeah.
Okay. So, did you have a chance to check out the definition of a seraph, whether it's considered?
Well, yes, it's basically a winged serpent. And,
okay.
Herodotus even mentioned in his book 2 of his history, it's called Euterpe, it's all about Egypt. He actually mentions winged serpents.
Okay.
Even though I don't think we've ever actually identified anything.
Right.
And I'm not positive what Herodotus was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He does mention what Rawlinson translated as a winged serpent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe there were such things like pterodactyls. Maybe they were still around.
Well, it may have been some large insect or something. I don't know. I really can't picture it.
Yeah.
I don't have the life experience to...
Yes. Okay, and you're not psychic either, right?
No, I've never really studied this manner in depth.
Right.
Opposed to the archaeological record, except for the mention in Herodotus and
mm-hmm.
what Strong says.
Yeah. Okay. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he did fly. Okay, so we're talking about these winged serpents. And one cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." So these seraphims are still, whether they're called winged serpents or in angelology.
They might just be a dragonfly. How about that?
Right. But in angelology, they're considered to be, I think, the second highest next to beneath the cherubs. Okay.
Well, I don't know whose angelology that is, though.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a lot of books on that subject. Okay. Verse 4. Well, I mean, if they were dragonflies, they wouldn't be saying...
Well, it just sounds Catholic to me, that's all.
Right. Okay. Verse 4. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then said I, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of hosts."
Now, if Isaiah the prophet considered his own lips unclean,
mm-hmm.
how do so many self-righteous people today consider themselves otherwise?
Right, right. Yeah, and the vast majority of Judeo-Christians consider themselves clean simply because they believe in Jesus. Right? That's what they tell themselves.
Well, today there's an absolute cultural refusal to humble oneself.
That's right. Absolutely. Verse 6. Then flew one of the seraphims to me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar, and he laid it upon my mouth and said, "Lo, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin purged." Okay, well, this to me presages the trial by fire, which is...
Well, you know, right. Fire represents trials of this life,
uh-huh.
and that's 1 Peter 1:7 elucidates that.
Yes.
But fire on the tongue, yeah, you know, it also represents the turmoil that an untrue tongue can cause.
Mm-hmm.
James chapter 3. Well, yeah. Look at what a great catastrophe a small member
mm-hmm.
can set off, and he compares it to a small flame lighting up a whole forest, right?
Right.
But
right.
I think it's really representative of the cleansing power of the Word of God.
Sure.
Well, when you put the power of the Word of God on your tongue,
mm-hmm.
and Yahshua said, "I have come to spread fire on the earth."
Yes.
Which yes. is the true meaning of the gospel.
Right. So prophetically, this would have to be in reference to the second coming, which will be with fire, because the first coming was forgiveness without fire. Okay. So I would see this as prophetic of the end times. Okay, verse 8. Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Then said I, "Here am I, send me." Of course, we're all supposed to say that. we're the ones who are supposed to step into the breach And of course, there are many and vast breaches. The tidal wave of iniquity in our current world today is pretty hard to stand against, but we have to do it anyway. Verse 9, and he said, go and tell this people, hear you indeed, but understand not, and see you indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes. That's Judeo-Christianity, folks. It's liberalism, too. Lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed. So, yeah.
Now, a lot of people, even identity pastors, try to say that, yeah, you know, where this is quoted in the New Testament, they try to say, well, those are the Edomites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, certainly partly, yeah.
This passage is quoted or referenced 6 times in the New Testament.
Uh-huh.
And every gospel quotes it once.
Okay.
It's in Acts 28, and it's in Romans 11.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that in truth this relates to those of us
right.
who are blinded by the Edomites.
That's right.
For those who rejected the gospel at that time and at this time,
mm-hmm.
and the word of Yahweh, there's no healing in this life.
Right.
Or possibly the next.
Right.
And the blindness the blindness is actually, because of our stiff neck, the blindness is a form of punishment from Yahweh for our disobedience.
Right.
And I can cite Deuteronomy 29:4. Yet Yahweh has not given to you a heart to perceive,
mm-hmm.
and eyes to see and ears to hear
unto
this day. And he's talking to the people who had seen all the wonders in Egypt.
Right. Right.
And only Yahweh chooses whose eyes are open and whose are not.
Well, yeah, and then, of course, we were talking about self-righteousness here. It's self-righteousness that prevents people from seeing reality. Okay? These self-righteous Judeo-Christians simply say, well, we have no sin because sin has been abolished. Therefore, you know, we have no worries, we have no concerns.
And in the first century, the people following the Pharisees that allowed them to and the Sadducees that allowed them to destroy Christ and persecute the apostles, they were self-righteous because they were circumcised and followed the law.
Right, exactly.
Or thought they were following
it. And today it's kind of the opposite, isn't it?
Yes, it's precisely the opposite.
Right. But they're still deluded and blind for opposite reasons. Verse 11. Then said I, Lord, how long? Oh, how long? How long do we have to put up with this, Lord? How long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. So what happened to Jerusalem, what literally happened to Jerusalem, actually twice, because it happened just before the Babylonian captivity, and it happened after the crucifixion. So it's going to happen to Israel one last time on a worldwide basis. Okay? Verse 12. And then Yahweh. And Yahweh have removed men far away, and there be a great forsaking in the midst of the land. There has been a tremendous forsaking of the Bible by organized Christianity. A total forsaking of the Bible. Verse 13. But yet in it shall be a tenth. By the way, it was 10% of the members of Revolutionary America that fought the revolution. 90% stood by and watched, right? And it shall return.
For the most part, yes.
Yes. And it shall return. By the way, those were the militia folks, the real militia. And it shall return and shall be eaten as a teal tree and as an oak whose substance is in them. When they cast their leaves, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof.
Now let me, you know, this last verse points to the remnant and to me the temporary kingdom of Judea.
Okay.
And all the translations of this verse that I've seen insist on rendering almost every word perfectly literally.
Okay.
Without metaphor.
Right.
And a long time ago, I studied this verse, and this is how I translated it then, and this is pretty old, so I stand by it, but I'm not saying it's 100% accurate, but I would translate this, yet a tenth shall return to be kindled, a pillar of oak, in order to be a monument.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because of their felling, the holy seed will be a monument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, but definitely we're talking about the holy seed.
And the pinnacle of that monument is Christ.
Yes.
The chief cornerstone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. All right, chapter 7, verse 1. And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that reason. Okay, so he's recounting 2 Kings 16:6 here.
Well, 2 Kings 15:37
okay.
is where Rezin and Pekah, you know,
right.
first make their allegiance and go against Judah.
Right.
And where it says the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, that's sons and grandsons alike.
Okay.
It shows you that word, because Ahaz can't be both their sons, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, one's his grandfather.
Uh-huh.
I just thought I'd point that out.
Yeah, okay. Okay, let me just start from the top here. And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. So here's one of our many internecine, intertribal wars, okay? But this time we have both the house of Judah and the house of Israel allied with foreign powers.
Well, don't forget that, you know, the king of Syria, Aram, is the brother of the ancestor of Arphaxad, the ancestor of the Hebrews.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I mean, these are cousins that
were right.
They're the same race. They're both Shemites.
Right. It's more into, you know, even the countries we're allied with are our kinsmen. But of different empires, right?
Right, and wherever you see Syria in the Hebrew, the Hebrew word is Aram.
Okay. So the Aramites and the Israelites and the Judahites, and who's the other? I'm forgetting what the other nation is that's involved here. I think the Assyrians were involved in this too.
Well, not quite. They're almost here, but they're not quite here.
Not quite. Okay.
This is probably. It's probably about 750. It's definitely between 750 and 745 BC. It's probably closer to 750.
Okay, so the Assyrian captivity or Assyrian invasion had not quite happened yet, but it was
right.
Building.
But the Assyrians had actually by this time invaded Syria a couple of times.
Okay,
they invaded Syria for the first time I think about 812 BC or something like that.
Uh huh. Oh, okay. Yeah, so the Assyrians could be involved in this in some way here, but let's continue. And it was told the house of David, saying, Syria is confederate with Ephraim, and his heart was moved, and the heart of his people, as the trees of the wood are moved with the wind. Of course, the house of Ephraim means the 10 northern tribes.
Right, and this word confederate actually means rests on.
Mm-hmm.
And that indicates to me that Ephraim was the major power in this alliance.
Yes.
That
right.
the Syrians were resting on Ephraim. They were depending on Ephraim to pull this off.
Right. And, of course, Ephraim was the largest of the tribes, most populous, and was the leading tribe.
Well, right. But it's Ephraim here denotes all the northern tribes.
Right. Yeah.
As opposed to Judah.
Very often Ephraim is used synonymously with the 10 northern tribes, the house of Israel. Yes. Verse 3. Then said Yahweh to Isaiah, go forth now to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub, your son.
And Shear-Jashub means the remnant shall return in Hebrew.
Ah, fascinating. Shear-Jashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field. Okay, what does that mean? The Fuller's upper
pool. A Fuller's Field. A Fuller is, a cloth. Fixer, a cloth maker.
Okay.
So maybe it's just where the fuller grew his flax or something to make
okay.
his cloth.
At the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of
well,
the
that has to be like a like an aqueduct.
Okay.
That conduit.
Okay. All right. So meet him there, and say to him, take heed and be quiet. Fear not, neither be faint-hearted for the two tails of these smoking firebrands. For the fierce anger of Rezin with Syria and of the son of Remaliah, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us, and set a kingdom in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. Okay, so for, at this point, I have to bring up the Joseph Scepter crowd, because it's clearly telling us that the Yahweh is defending the house of Judah, okay, against, and he did it also when the Assyrians attacked under Sennacherib, defended the house of Judah. The Bible clearly tells us that. So it's not possible for the house of Judah to be Mamzers. It just isn't, okay, which they like to claim that the house of Judah is. Okay, verse 7, thus says Yahweh Elohim, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. That is this invasion by organized Ephraim against Judah. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is reason. And within 65 years shall Ephraim be broken, that it be not a people. Major, major prophecy here. And have you had time to...
Well, the last of the deportations of Israel,
yeah.
I believe, while they are not recorded explicitly in Scripture,
mm-hmm.
seem to have occurred in the time of Esarhaddon,
okay.
who reigned in Assyria from 681 to 669 BC.
Okay.
He's mentioned at 2 Kings 19:37, at
right.
Isaiah 37:38, and at Ezra 4:2.
Okay.
Now, in Ezra 4:2, it is mentioned, it's evident that during his reign, he had brought people in from elsewhere
right.
into Israel after the Israelites were deported. Now, this seems to be during his reign that Ephraim ceased to be a nation.
Okay.
Now 65 years from the first deportation, in which we know occurred, when the Assyrians first came into the land, it was 741 B.C.,
okay. Well,
and 65 years later is 676 B.C.
Okay. Well, I've found evidence that Tiglath-Pileser deported half the tribe of Manasseh, but was from the east side of the Jordan River. That part of the tribe that was in 745 B.C.
Well, even if you go to 745 B.C., we're taught 65 years later is
right.
is 680 B.C.
Okay.
So it's still within the range of Esarhaddon.
Right. Right.
And his rule.
So Isaiah is talking about a literal 65-year period that incorporates the entire deportation of all 10 northern tribes.
Right. And let me say that the best work I found on the Assyrian deportations of Israel, I think it's an excellent work,
uh-huh.
is J. Llewellyn Thomas, The Assyrian Invasions and Deportations of
okay.
Israel.
Okay, right.
And he refers to the last of the deportations being under Esarhaddon and 676 B.C.
Okay. Yeah,
but he is using the reference in Ezra and the 65-year prophecy
yes.
to substantiate that.
Okay, do you have a handle on the date that Sennacherib pulled out from the invasion of Jerusalem? Wasn't that around 700 AD BC rather?
Well, he ruled from 704 to 681 BC.
Oh,
and I know that he died. That he was slain right after that defeat by his son.
Right.
And Esarhaddon got the throne.
Okay.
And so okay. it couldn't have been too far before 681 B.C.
Okay.
If my memory serves me correctly, because I did not research that.
Right. And Esarhaddon would have been the last Assyrian king then to engage in deporting the Israelites. Okay.
Yes. And in 6... Yeah, you know, I got two dates in my head, and I don't know which one's right. It's either 613 or 608 B.C. that Assyria was destroyed.
Okay, yeah.
By the Scythians and the Medes, primarily.
Uh-huh. Okay. But this is a literal 65-year period that Isaiah is prophesying, okay? And so, you know, I know there's a few other commentators who've written about this era, demonstrating the 65 years to be factual, okay? And so we haven't had time to research this, completely. But definitely that's what this prophecy is about, okay?
Well, there's no doubt to me.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you want to go from 745 to the time of Esarhaddon or from 741, mm-hmm. We go from Tiglath-Pileser
yes.
and the first invasions, the first comings into Israel by the Assyrians, and Ezra and Isaiah – both put this, both mentioned this Esarhaddon, and Ezra puts them in Israel by no later than 676. So that's 65 years is clearly, is clearly there.
Yes.
And if S.R. Hatton had deported Israelites, who would be there to record it? That's, you know, that's
very
like
cute.
The certificate of divorce for Judah.
Right.
They all like to point out Judah wasn't divorced, and I've proved that Judah was divorced.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, a prophet from Judah recorded the divorce of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, well, who was there to write anything when Judah was put away?
Right, right. And then what, I think we talked about this last time, what was the time frame of when these Isaiah prophecies were written?
Well, from 752 B.C. probably forward.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, you know, I'd have to go back and look at last week's notes, but it's definitely the he started writing just before 752 B.C.
Okay.
Because so Uzziah died right around 752 B.C., and his death's recorded in Isaiah chapter 6.
Okay, and so this is definitely prophetic. There's no way around this. This is a period. There's a prophecy about a period of 65 years of deportations. Okay, verse 9. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, okay, meaning the head city. And the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son.
Which is Pekah.
Pekah, okay. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Okay, stand at all, not be. You shall not reign if you will not believe.
Well, you know, Isaiah is, you know, this is a prophecy. He's stating, he's probably uttering this publicly.
Yes.
That this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he probably wasn't very popular for it.
Oh, yeah.
And
right.
But he's admonishing the people.
Right.
If you don't believe, you will not stand, is basically what he's telling.
Well, yeah, this is a prophecy against the northern tribes. Absolutely. Verse 10, moreover, Yahweh spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask you a sign of Yahweh, your God, your Elohim. Ask it either in the depths or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. Neither will I tempt Yahweh. And he said, hear you now, O house of David. Is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? Therefore, Yahweh, or the Lord himself, shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. Okay? Now, this is obviously an Israelite prophecy. And if the Jews are the Israelites, why don't they accept this prophecy? Okay.
You know, these words, I have a note here that these words are written circa 750 B.C.
Okay.
I mean, it's not long after Uzziah's death. And while there are many philosophies connecting the various creation myths of the pagan gods with Christian testimony or, you know, the Hebrew Bible, all of which can be tied into the Hebrew Genesis accounts and myths from the other related cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen no evidence whatsoever that any of the authentic so-called God-born of virgin birth stories predate these words of Isaiah's.
Right, right.
There's much evidence that these words of Isaiah's were spread far and wide and preceded any of those God born a virgin birth story.
And plus, our people were spread far and wide.
Well,
and they knew these prophecies, and local cultures got wind of it. And that's where these myths come from.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
That the
zeitgeist.
The comparable tales concerning the Book of Nezah 2.
Yeah.
Well, that's not until the Neo-Babylonian period that those tales existed
yeah.
in Babylonian inscriptions.
Yeah, the basic,
and that's after 600 B.C.
Right. The basic premise of Zeitgeist, that movie, is to suggest that all of these, quote-unquote myths existed well before the Israelites. And it's not true. It's not true. If they did exist before the Israelites, it was only because of the prophetic Maseroth that was described, you know, by Joseph Seiss and Bullinger and others, and even who's the chronicler, Capt, E. Raymond Capt, all talk about the prophetic Maseroth, that these prophecies were very, very ancient, and one of the prophecies contained a virgin birth. So it's still Hebrew Israelite literature. That's
well, right, and I don't find a virgin birth before the time before these words of Isaiah.
Right, it's certainly not recorded in writing. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And the Krishna tale, yeah, you know, I have no evidence at all. I mean, a lot of people like to attribute great antiquity to that tale. That's nothing but a perversion of the gospel.
Right, right. No, in fact, when Suzanne Olson was on my show, I asked her, how old is the Hindu religion? And she said 300 BC.
Okay. Well, right, but I believe the Krishna tale is actually a later layer
right.
Grafted into the Hindu religion.
Exactly, exactly. Hinduism is nothing but a borrowing from other religions and from mythology and from whatever they could borrow from. They add to it the pretense that it's older than 300 BC, right? That's what Hinduism is.
Even though those people had no writing whatsoever, it's that antiquity.
It was all Aryan writing, okay? So they borrowed the Aryan writings and claimed to have originated them. That's what Hinduism is. This is another phony religion. Okay?
Well, right. But my challenge to the people that believe that is always to show me the papyri with
right.
the Krishna tale. Dating to before the time of Christ.
Right, and there aren't any. Exactly.
You won't ever find one.
That's right. That's right. It's all made up stuff. Hinduism is a made up religion. Buddhism is a made up religion. Judaism is a made up religion. Islam is a made up religion, and of course, Judeo-Christianity is a made up religion. The only real religion is biblical Christianity. Verse 15: Butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. Okay, well, folks, we're supposed to choose good and refuse evil. That's pretty plain, right? Verse 16. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good.
Well, which is a metaphor or an idiom for, in other words, before the child even lives.
Right, right, yeah. The land that you abhor shall be forsaken of both her kings. Okay, again, this seems to be a prophecy of the Assyrian captivity. Verse 17, Yahweh shall bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall hiss for the fly that is in the uttermost part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. What are we talking
about? He's whistling for the people. This isn't
another signal.
Yes, it's another signal. And the Egyptians were, allied with the Assyrians at the time and came against the Israelites probably as as a duty to the Assyrians.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
It's just an idiom that, for the fly is the Egyptians and the bee are the Assyrians.
Right, right. And then those two nations were confederate against Israel for a while, against the house of Judah, yes. Okay, verse 19, and they shall come and shall rest all of them in the desolate valleys and in the holes of the rocks and upon all thorns and upon all bushes. In the same day shall Yahweh shave with a razor that is hired, namely by them beyond the river and by the king of Assyria the head, and the hair of the feet, and it shall also consume the beard. In other words, it's going to be a total sweeping away of the 10 northern tribes, right? Isn't that what the...
Well, this is not only... I mean, the Assyrians came and took most of Judah, too.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, before, as part of the Babylonian captivity. Yes, okay. And it shall come to pass in that day... I'm sorry. Are we talking about Sennacherib here?
Yeah. Well, the Assyrians took 46 times cities of Judah long before the battle.
Right, right, exactly. Thank you. Okay, verse 21, and it shall come to pass in that day that a man shall nourish a young cow and two sheep, and it shall come to pass for the abundance of milk that they shall give, he shall eat butter, for butter and honey shall everyone eat that is left in the land, and it shall come to pass in that day that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silverlings, it shall be even for briars and thorns. Okay, so obviously the prosperity is taken away. Verse 24, with arrows and with bows shall men come there, because all the land shall become briars and thorns. And on all hills that shall be dug with the mattock, there shall not come there the fear of briars and thorns, but it shall be for the sending forth of oxen and for the treading of lesser cattle. So this sounds like this is the judgment of the city of Jerusalem and the house of Judah, okay? Or it could still be the judgment of the 10 northern tribes, okay? What's your feeling on these last few verses here?
Well, it's the judgment on both lands.
Both.
Because
okay.
When the Assyrians are done, only the inhabitants of Jerusalem are left.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Isaiah is prophesying the judgment of both the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Okay, chapter 8, verse 1. Moreover, Yahweh said to me, take you a great roll and write in it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalhasha.
Well,
Hashbaz.
Maher
Shalhashbaz.
It means in making speed to the spoil, he hastens the prey.
Okay. So he's coming quickly.
And a pen is not a ballpoint, it's a stylus.
right, exactly. Verse 2, unlike the
Anne Frank diary.
Right, exactly. You took the words out of my mouth. And I took to me faithful witnesses to record Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah.
This can't be, the prophet Zechariah from the book is the son of Berechiah.
Okay.
And he wrote much later during the Persian period. That's clear from his testimony.
Right. So
and it seems to me that this might be a forebear because the Hebrews repeated patterns of name usage within the family. It's possible.
Yeah.
But this, Zechariah, the son of Jeberechiah, as opposed to Zechariah, the son of Berechiah.
Right.
That's awfully close there.
Right. So, it's not uncommon for ancestors or descendants to name themselves after their ancestors in that kind of order. Yeah, not a problem. Okay, verse 3. And I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son. Then said Yahweh to me, call his name Maher Shalhashbaz.
Now, Hosea was a contemporary of Isaiah.
Okay.
And he was told to go into a whore.
Right.
And Isaiah got to go into a prophetess. I mean, there's a correlation here. It seems to be a common routine at this time.
Yes.
With the prophets.
Yes. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. Okay. So if these are all contemporaries, he's saying all is going to happen in a very short time. If he was prophesying in 750 B.C., then it began 5 years later. Or if you count from when the Assyrians crossed the Jordan River and started taking our people from the west side of the Jordan River, 741 B.C., okay? Verse 5, Yahweh spoke also to me, saying, for as much as this people refused the waters of Shiloah, that go softly and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son. Now, therefore, behold, Yahweh brings up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria. So here we have an example of the waters and the river being the people of Assyria. Okay? And we're confronted with this imagery in the book of Revelation as well. Remember, there's a prophecy that the waters of Tigris and Euphrates will dry up, and that means that there will be no more Israelites coming from that area. And today they have dried up, folks. There's no more Israelites coming from that area.
Well, I actually believe that allowed the Turks to advance. That was the signal that the mm-hmm. hordes from the east would descend on us.
Yes.
Because that's where it talks about the army of 200 million.
Right. Yeah. So we definitely have this imagery of waters and rivers referring to people, no doubt about it. Verse 8.
Oh, the river that comes from the mouth of the serpent, that's the children of Israel, there's no doubt.
You mean it's not just bad talk, evil rhetoric? Okay, verse 8. And it shall pass through Judah, it shall overflow, and it did. Okay, Sennacherib and Esarhaddon. He shall reach even to the neck, and the neck would be what, the moat. I forgot the name of the king who was in Jerusalem when Sennacherib attacked. But he diverted the waters of the river so that the city of Jerusalem would have water during the siege. And they also built moats, I think, around the city as well.
He built a tunnel down under the Temple Mount, down under the palace.
So you're saying that the king of Assyria right up to the neck but was unable to take the head of the city of Jerusalem, okay? And and strong and many, even the king of Syria. And, okay, I'm sorry. Let me go back to verse 8 here. And it shall pass through Judah. It shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of its wings shall fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel.
Now I don't know if this is an allusion to Christ.
Uh-huh.
I think this is a prayer.
Yes, okay.
That, you know, that the Assyrians shall fill the land. Oh, God be with us.
Right.
You know, in other words,
yes.
This, you know, this is a great tragedy.
Right, right, yeah. So proper name here, you think, is misplaced?
Well,
oh,
I think it should have been
us.
Translated. It would have been better in context.
Yes, yes. Okay, verse 9. Associate yourselves, O you people, and you shall be broken in pieces. Okay, that means you make covenants with non-Israelites, you will be broken in pieces. We're told this a million times in Scripture. And give ear, all you of far countries, gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. If we make alliances with non-Israelites, we will be broken in pieces. Verse 10, take counsel together, and it shall come to nothing. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. Now, Bill.
Well, let me say that I think that this is telling, you know, Isaiah telling the Israelites to make no plot against this thing coming to pass.
Right.
Okay. You know, don't go try to join up with anybody else to prevent the Assyrians from taking this land, because if that happens, you're going to be punished.
Right, right, yeah. The Judahites shouldn't do that, yeah. And the council, going back to Deuteronomy 7, is we're not to make any covenants with non-Israelite nations.
Well, that's absolutely right. But
mm-hmm.
but it's also from the perspective that, you know, you're going to be deported. You really
right.
don't have anything to do about it.
Well, right. And that was the problem that Jeremiah had with the house of Judah. He prophesied, he told them, for your own good, you shall be taken to Babylon. It's for your own good. And if you resist this prophecy, you will be killed. And that's what happened to the Judahites, who decided not to allow themselves to be taken captive and went to Egypt instead. Okay?
Right.
So this,
and I think we're in the same predicament today.
Right, exactly.
Our kingdom's handed over to the beast.
Yes.
And there's really nothing way to do about it.
Well, we're to obey Yahweh's law, and we're supposed to create our own Israelite community. And
well, right, but there's no resistance. You know, we're not supposed to march on Washington and try
right,
to have
right.
the beast out.
Yeah, and we're told over and over again, if we simply obey his law and build the kingdom and come out of Babylon,
then the beast will be cast down.
That's right. Okay, but yeah, and the scriptures also say that there's really who can make war against the beast. We can't make literal war against the beast.
No,
we can only
make
spiritual
war.
That's right. And so this spiritual war is a moral war, and it's a racial war, and we have to, get our people together to prevent the racial war from destroying us, because that's what they're doing. That's what the Jews are trying to do to us, destroy our race. Okay.
Well, absolutely, and they're powerless when we separate ourselves from them.
Right. Right. When we build separate Israelite community, Yahweh protects us. Yes. Okay. That's what our people should be doing. However, the churches are doing exact opposite. So, verse 10 then, take counsel together and it shall come to nothing. Speak the word and it shall not stand, for God is with us. Okay. God is with us still, if we will but agree with him, obey his laws and take his counsel. Verse 11. For Yahweh spoke thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, quote, say you not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy? In other words, everybody's saying we should be confederate with some other nation, maybe Egypt.
Well, right, to join themselves against the Assyrians.
Right, because we need an ally, right?
Egypt,
no.
Syria, Israel, whoever.
Yes, but Yahweh is
well,
our
Judah
ally.
And Israel together.
Yahweh is our ally. We don't need the Egyptians, right?
Well, right, and he's already said that this, you know, he's decreed this deportation is going to happen.
Right.
But he's also promised that the prey would be taken off in safety.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that if you really don't resist it, that everything will be well
It'll
with
be,
you.
And as it turned out, when the Babylonians were overthrown, the Medes and Persians were very favorable to Israel, to Judah. Right? Isn't that exactly what happened?
Once the and that's much later.
Later.
But when the Israelites are deported, they actually become, they're settled by the Araxes River in northern Media.
Mm-hmm.
Theodorus Siculus says that's where the nation of the Scythians started out.
Yes.
And they rose to be a great power. They ruled over all
right.
Asia for 25 years.
Yes.
And for some reason, and there's no historical impetus for it that we could tell, after Nineveh was destroyed,
mm-hmm.
the Scythians withdrew from Asia and crossed the Caucasus Mountains.
Right.
But
right.
for the most part.
So these verses are basically telling us about the Assyrian deportation, that even though we were deported because of our evil practices in adopting Canaanite religion, that the ultimate result of this would be good if we will, you know, not resist. However, isn't it true that a great number of the Israelites decided to flee before the Assyrian invasion by a ship?
Well, it seems to be that the tribe of Dan did.
Yes,
they're not mentioned in conjunction with the deportations.
Right.
And it's at that very time that the Tuatha De Danann appear in Ireland.
Okay, yeah. And also the Cumru appear in Wales. Okay.
Well, I think that the Cymru came much later.
Much later. Okay.
I think that the Cymru are actually Cimmerians.
Right.
Who were the they were called Cymru by the Assyrians.
Okay.
And the
yes.
Cimmerian, the first branch of Scythians to cross into Europe, did so at a time when the Assyrian language, Akkadian,
mm-hmm.
was the lingua franca.
Okay.
And these people coming from the east, the Greeks wondered about.
Okay.
And they learned that their name was the Cymru or Cimmeroi.
Yes.
From the Assyrians.
Right.
Because that was the lingua franca.
Right, but that word means Omri, as in King Omri Israel.
Yeah. Yes. And they were called Cymru by the Assyrians.
Right. Right.
Because of King Omri.
Exactly.
Now,
so, yes.
the subsequent waves of Scythians that came into Europe, okay, the Greek knew them as Saka.
Uh-huh.
And the Greeks knew them as Saka because by that time, Persian or Aramaic had become the lingua franca.
Right.
And the Persians called those same people that
uh-huh.
the Assyrians called Cymru.
Yes.
The Persians called them Saka.
Right.
And that's proven from trilingual inscriptions.
Yeah, the Behistun Rock, I believe it was.
Yes.
It has that trilingual inscription. Yeah.
Yes.
So,
and this is
history, folks. It's archaeological history.
So now the Cymru, that they end up, according to Roman records, they end up on the shores of the Baltic,
uh-huh.
at the mouth of the Rhine.
Right.
And I believe that that's where the Cymru of Wales or of Britain at that time.
So Wagner was right. he must have had some glimmering knowledge of all of this.
They were the first Scythians to cross the English Channel into Britain. And
yes.
I think that probably happened around 400 BC.
Okay.
At the same time that a branch of them, the same people who the Greeks knew as Galatahi,
yes.
but they were the same people, and they're associated in later histories that the Galatahi who invaded Italy are the Cimmerians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there's historic references to that in my German origins papers, and I have my citations down.
Okay.
And the Galatahi are the Cimmerians and the Cymru of England, and they a group of them or a tribe of them probably crossed the English Channel around 400.
Right, right. And, of course, verse 13 stresses what we've been saying here. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. Okay? We're supposed to rely on Yahweh, and we're supposed to fear him. Okay? Of course,
right.
our people never do.
Not even on our brother. Not even on our cousins. Right.
Yeah, our people never do. They always abandon Yahweh in favor of whatever local power they can ally themselves with, right? Verse 14, and he, Yahweh, shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, and for a gin and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Okay, so he's talking about the same fact, he's talking about both deportations. Okay, verse 15. And many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and taken. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. Okay. All right, I'm going to have to call it quits at this point because I have an appointment I have to go to. But, yeah, I mean, how many times does the Bible have to say that Yahweh is our refuge and our hope and also our punishment if we don't follow him? How many times does the Bible have to say that before we get it? And our people just don't want to hear it.
No, and they don't want to apply the same prophecy and theory to today. They don't want to imply the same sound advice to today.
That's right.
They want to take matters into their own hands. Yeah. That they want to do stupid things like form militias and go follow FBI agents off into perdition.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's no end to it.
Right, yeah. And Matthew says in the chat room, I'm surprised he's not really angry with us now. He is. He is a very forgiving God. You know, from my perspective, too forgiving. But obviously, it's his call. Okay? He has guaranteed us a remnant, and that the remnant would be true to his word. And Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 clearly prophesied that the vast majority of Israelites, today's Christians, will not understand and will be deluded and go off in all the wrong directions possible. And that's what's happening. It's as plain as day. But they can't see it because they have blind guides who are leading them into the ditch.
Well, there's no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely no doubt. Okay. So this book of Isaiah, it's just full of prophecy. But, Bill, before we go, let me just ask you this question. How could anybody possibly understand this book without knowing the true history of the 12 tribes of Israel?
Oh, as we progress through this book, you'll see that there is absolutely no way.
Mm-hmm.
That if you don't know your history, you'll never understand Isaiah.
That's right. Isaiah, you must know the history of our people to understand Isaiah. There is no other way to understand Isaiah.
And Isaiah will prove that the Scythian Germanic people are the children of Israel.
That's right. That's right. Okay, very good. We're making tremendous progress here. Looking forward to doing this again next Friday. Tomorrow we're going to have a Passover service with Pastor George Udvari leading us in the first half hour. And then Bill and I are going to be talking about, for the balance of that show, talking about recent discoveries in the Dead Sea Scrolls that verify what we've been saying about the book of Galatians, that the works of the law means rituals of the law, and it even means the Pharisaic distortions of the law. That's what Paul really means by that expression, works of the law. Does not mean good works. That's the false interpretation of the Judeo-Christian churches, folks. They've got that wrong. What don't they have wrong, right? Okay, so looking forward to tomorrow night's show. And then also on Sunday, my guest will be Jonathan Gray. We're going to be talking about the Holy Blood and various other archaeological discoveries in the Middle East. And Jonathan Gray, obviously a professional archaeologist, so that should be a good show too. Okay, so thank you all for listening. Bill, see you tomorrow night.
Praise Yahweh.
Okay, praise Yahweh. Yahweh bless everybody.